This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station, broadcasting live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from Hart House, University of Toronto.
Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. We are the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. And we are myself, Jams, and joining me in studio,
Adnan Hussein. Hello.
Hello.
Recovered.
Recovered.
Mally, a.k.a. DocuVixen.
Adrian Worrell.
And Kemba King.
And as I said, we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. And from 3 to 4, we discuss important issues like social justice, decolonization, identity, resistance culture, environmental justice, and all those types of things. And then from 4 to 5, myself and or DJ Griffin. And or DJ Budnan, a.k.a. Add It Up, brings you music to move you. We'll be doing that today. But first, joining us in studio, I would like to welcome back. She has she's been here a couple of times already, but we are always honored to have her, Zainab Amadahi. She is a mother, writer, and activist. Her publications include the novel Moons of Palmares, as well as an essay in the anthology Strong Women Stories, Native Vision and Community Activism. Most recently, Zainab has contributed to In Breach of the Colonial Contract by co-authoring Indigenous Peoples and Black People in Canada, Settlers or Allies. And her most recent publication, available on Amazon.com, is Wielding the Force, The Science of Activism. Welcome back to the Vibe Collective, Zainab.
Thanks, Jemias. It's actually The Science of Social Justice. You were probably reading one of my pre-titles, my test titles.
I was.
Yes,
so
thank
sorry.
You for mentioning it. Yeah.
It's not like we have the book in front of us now.
Yeah.
The Science of Social Justice, which is a really, really intriguing title. Do you want to, before we get into the workshop, do you want to talk a little bit about that title and about the content of Wielding the Force?
Sure. Let me just say, first of all, that the reason that I wrote the book was that as an activist, I noticed in many of the activities that I was working on that there's a resistance sometimes to the inclusion of ceremony or other types of spiritual practices in the work. And So that was a concern. In addition to that, I started to find scientific information when I was researching other things, emerging science, that was kind of validating Indigenous practices, spiritual and cultural practices, as being really good, physically healthy, good for well-being in the sense of, enhancing the quality of relationships and all kinds of other things. And so I kind of thought, well, if I can use the language of science, and it doesn't matter to me whether people identify as spiritual or not, I still respect where people are coming from, the contributions they can make. But if I can speak to people using perhaps the language of science because that's their preference, then maybe I could help people understand how and why some of the spiritual practices and cultural practices that are, you know, from indigenous communities at a global level as well as at a local level, you know, why these things are valid and necessary and how they contribute to global individual and community well-being.
It's I really appreciate that you're taking that perspective, because I think a lot of us get caught up in the work and not necessarily in healing of ourselves, right? That we're looking, you know, we're constantly on the grind of activism, and but not necessarily always taking those practices home.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that self-care is really important, and I think that's one aspect of the implications of the work that I've done. But I also think that it's a much bigger question, and I think the question has to do with knowledge paradigms and knowledge ways and life ways, and the values that inform them. So, you know, I really, you know, again, I've written about this, and sometimes people don't take this very well, but, you know, I've written about the idea of people coming in with what are essentially, to me, Eurocentric ways of knowing, and trying to, you know, impose that way of thinking on other people as if we don't understand injustice from, you know, our own knowledge ways, our own paradigms, right? So I'm speaking to that a little bit as well. Like, I don't want to denigrate, you know, different knowledge ways, but because I think they, you know, they all have their purpose, and they all, evolved, you know, from a place of need. And I think they are essentially all land informed at some point. But, you know, I also think that there's an aspect of missionizing and colonizing that comes with people who, you know, have very strong political philosophies and then try and impose them on other peoples. Yeah.
So today you're joining us not just to talk about your book, but you have a workshop that I've had the honor and pleasure of participating in. And I was actually doing one of the exercises at home with my family last night. They were really, really excited by long cool. fingers. So do you want to go ahead and start your workshop?
I guess the first thing, thank you, that I want to just let people know is that we're trying to have an online component to this workshop. So if you happen to be near a computer and you can log on to the Vibe Collective's Facebook, you'll see that we have already posted some JPEGs up there with questions that I'm hoping that we have the time to discuss. And if we don't have the time to discuss, that I can respond to at a later time. You can also tweet in your comments as usual. I think the Vibe Collective is always, you know, open to tweets and phone calls and many other ways of interacting with folks on the show. And so I hope that people do that today. You know, and I'm going to be as well, again, if you can get to your Facebook, or if you can access it later, the postings will still be there. So I'm hoping to upload, you know, some visuals, because some people are visual learners, and I want everybody to be able to connect to what I have to offer today. And I'm going to start with looking at knowledge paradigms or frameworks. And then I'm going to look at what emerging science is saying about wellness and human interaction. And I'm going to be, if we have time, looking at the implications of that information for social justice, social movements, and activism. As well, I'm going to give myself a little plug here, just because I think if people want to you know, comment on my work or challenge me or critique me or just engage with me, I'm really open to that. And my website is www.swallowsongs.com. I'll repeat that at the end. But again, you know, if you want to connect with me that way, that's perfectly fine. I'm happy to engage with people around these issues. So the way I often begin my workshops these days is to talk about the difference between how your left brain processes information and how your right brain processes information. And I'm also going to urge everybody else in the studio here with me to, you know, to jump in if they have comments, information, things to add, questions to challenge me with, or anything. I'm not here to lecture. I didn't want it to be a lecture. I really want this to be interactive. So please just signal and I'll shut my mouth and please chime in. So the reason that I look at the right and left brain, because as I said, it allows us to understand some of the differences between knowledge paradigms, worldviews, ideologies, and value systems. Let me just see if I can. I'm going to try and upload something here onto the website. But if we can just think for a moment, and maybe some of you can chime in on this question, what are some of the differences between how our right brain and left brain function, guys?
Well,
stop it! Like you're not children in a classroom. I know you guys know this stuff. So.
There's one side. One side is responsible for the creative, sort of imaginative, cognitive processes. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
And I pulled up the chart from your book.
go, Adnan, go.
Which I'm actually trying to put on the...
So we have left brain is linear, logical, analytical, math-friendly, ordering, thinks about facts, things in words, likes lyrics, and detail-oriented. And your right brain is feels, fantasizes, creates, imagines, intuits, is art-friendly, likes rhythm, melody, and is holistic.
Okay. I'm trying to get these graphics up, and I'm having a lot of trouble doing that. But thank you, Anand. Can you help me here, actually, with posting this on the Facebook?
I will try and do my very best.
This is on the flash drive, and this is on the thing. So anyways, yeah, so that's the kind of chart that I have in my book. I don't want to – I know that these are generalizations and that there's more to be discussed about the right and the left brain and how they function and how they interact, but – for the purposes of this discussion, I'd just like us to note that one side or the other side of our brain can dominate. So we can be left brain people or right brain people. I think most people know that. But we still use both of our hemispheres, right? So everybody has the capacity to draw on both knowledge ways simultaneously. Yeah, so that's important to recognize, even though sometimes, you know, one side or the other might be more dominant in an individual. So in this society, most academic institutions and most institutions anyway, you know, value what are considered to be left-brained skills or left-brained ways of knowing. So they like that we can be logical. They value those kinds of skills, the logical, rational thinking skills, the linear skills, And when I say in the book, I said looking at the parts is a left brain function. So the idea that we learn about things from their component parts, the idea that, for example, the more we learn about atoms, the more the atoms can tell us about molecules, the more we learn about molecules, they can tell us about the cells, for example, that of our bodies, and the more we learn about ourselves, the more we'll learn about how our bodies function. So it's just a way of learning about the world and knowing about the world. But the fact that most of the institutions in our society value left brain skills and teach us to be more left brain than right brain. Has implications, and the implications are, as we know, I mean, I don't know if, do you guys know about neuroplasticity? Is that a term you guys are familiar with?
That's the brain's ability to kind of like reprogram itself.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is that the brain is capable, based on our experiences or our perception of our experiences, to rewire itself, to change its physical structure, and also to change its function. You know, with neuroplasticity, which we know because when I was in medical technology, they used to tell me when I was studying that the brain, you know, by the time you're like between 20 and 24 years old, is basically, you know, carved in stone and it's not going to change. But we know that that's not true now and that people well into their 90s and beyond can reshape their brains. So, but the idea that, you know, because we've been, you know, left brain skills are so valued and we're all, you know, being trained to develop our left brain skills systematically in society means that, you know, often by the time we leave school, most of us tend to be left brain, and it may not be our natural inclination or our genetic inclination or whatever you want to say about inclinations. In terms of scientific paradigms, we kind of see the same thing at work here. If I can just borrow my computer for a moment. I don't know that we're going to get online here, so I apologize to folks that...
We are. I'm just troubleshooting.
Waiting for these postings. Okay. So,
which is my life.
If we look at scientific paradigms, and scientific, I mean, the word science comes from, I think it's a Greek word that means knowledge, but I know that the root word is knowledge. So, of course, all peoples have knowledge ways, right? But if we look at the dominant, colonial, mainstream paradigm in terms of knowledge, what we see is something that looks very left-brained, which isn't a surprise, I suppose. In terms of the scientific paradigm of the dominant culture, what they're looking at is to measure and quantify stuff. They're looking at, it's a very linear way of approaching things, approaching the collection of knowledge and the processing of knowledge. Excuse me. So it's linear. It looks for causality. So, you know, certain kinds of viruses cause colds, for example, right? It's reductionist. So, again, it looks at how the parts contribute to the whole. It is really interested in duplication and provability and empiricism. And it's a discipline. The sciences are hard sciences are set apart from other types of knowledge ways, right? So science is separate from art, science is separate from the social sciences, hard science is separate from philosophy, and so on. So it has a very specific and limited framework of reference. And this is important because, you know, knowledge paradigms and frameworks impact what questions get asked by a society, how information is collected, how information is interpreted, how it's valued, and how knowledge is applied, right? And if we go to the scientific paradigm of indigenous peoples, and we're not the only ones, I don't think indigenous peoples are the only ones to operate out of this paradigm. I think there are many ancient wisdom traditions that operate out of what I'm calling in my book an indigenous paradigm or a relational paradigm. And in that paradigm, it's much more important, rather than measuring and counting and quantifying, it's much more important to notice and align with the cycles and the rhythms and the patterns of nature. And it's important to understand that everything transforms and changes, that nothing is static, and that everything relates to everything else. So if you can think of the idea of a three-dimensional spider web, we're less concerned with one strand in the web than we are with how all the strands in the web kind of impact each other directly and indirectly. We also understand things by looking at the big picture and looking at how things function in their environment. So, for example, if you want to look at a plant, you want to study a particular plant, there's no need to take it out of its environment and cut it up and stain it and put it under a microscope, for example. But you look at that plant in its environment and you look at how that plant changes with the season, changes over time, you know, what grows around that plant, what doesn't grow around that plant. You know, what insects might be attracted or repelled by the plant, what animals, how are the animals using the plant? Are they eating it? Do they take the plant when they're sick? Like, how are they interacting with that plant? And in that way, you can learn more about it. So that's, you know, looking at things in terms of that's a holistic way of looking at things.
And just to add to that, I, not to go too far off topic, but if you think about, you know, Western science versus indigenous science. I believe it was, what's his name? The fractal guy, is it Mandelbrot? Who, when they were taking that paradigm into a forest, literally, they were looking at the measurement between each branch and each tree and looking at it holistically. In that way, they were able to see a much bigger and very complex picture and see how fractal patterns work in a forest. It just made me think of that. And it points to the difference between looking at something through, you know, as a microscope versus looking at it as in the big picture.
And in
its environment.
Thanks, Jemias. The other part that I talk about in my book, the other piece of indigenous ways of knowing or relational ways of knowing, is the fact that they don't separate, we don't separate science out as a separate discipline, that science relates to philosophy, art, mythology, ceremony, prayer. In fact, ceremony and prayer are ways of acquiring knowledge and ways of getting information or advice on how to apply knowledge, for example. So it's just, you know, I think it was Gregory Gahete in his book. He's a Tewa from the southern part of southwest part of the United States, one of the pueblos down there. And he wrote a book on Native science. And he says that science is basically just the story that we tell ourselves about how the world works, right? So this is the indigenous story. I wanted to move on to the role of the scientists, and I'll do that really quickly because I don't want to spend too much time on the whole paradigm thing, or we'll never get to some really fun stuff that I want to do. But again, the scientist in the mainstream way of thinking in mainstream science is supposed to be an objective observer. She's supposed to control, whatever she's looking at. So she's supposed to, you know, perhaps work in a laboratory, or at least control, if she's not in a laboratory, control things that might impact her experiment and her research. She's professionally trained. She's allowed to interfere with nature to learn about it. So she's allowed, you know, I mean, there are some limitations, but she is allowed to, you know, alter life forms at the genetic level. She's allowed to, even kill or maim or surgically alter or infect species with diseases so that she can learn things about them. She collects data in the search for what I call in my book tangible facts, and basically knowledge so that we can control. That's what I think, what I understand to be the aim of the dominant or mainstream science. So it's about control. And in his latest book, there's a theoretical physicist, Michio Kaku, who is actually American, and In his book, he talks about, he predicts that by the year 2100, humans are going to be, and I quote, masters of nature, and that, I quote again, our destiny is to become like the gods that we once worshipped and feared. And he excitedly declares that in this future, humans will enjoy perfect bodies and extended lifetimes, and will even be able to create life forms that have not previously walked the earth. So I don't know if that's a dystopia.
That sounds like Frankenstein to me.
Yeah.
We've all seen The Liger, right? So it's like it's been happening.
So yeah, I guess, but to the Eurocentric scientists, this is the goal. This is the goal, is to control our bodies, to control nature, so we, you know, won't ever have to suffer or experience death or anything. But the goal in indigenous science is much different. And we recognize in indigenous, and again, you know, like people will argue about, you know, whether the word science should be applied to indigenous knowledge ways, because, you know, people don't think that our knowledge ways are very scientific. But there's also, I also kind of agree that I'm not sure I want to apply the word science to our knowledge ways, because I don't think science is comprehensive enough to really, you know, do justice to our knowledge traditions, our life ways. But in the indigenous way of thinking, the participant, the inquirer, the scientist, as it were, you know, influences and is influenced by what she is studying. Her intention matters, her feeling matters, all of these things matter. It's also a community process oftentimes. So it's not an individual scientist. She's not disconnected from a community. I think that, in academia, for example, a lot of research, I mean, there's a community within academia that kind of like, holds research accountable or oversees or guides research or whatever. But I think that in indigenous ways of knowing, scientific inquiry is accountable more at a grassroots level, and a lot of people participate in the quest for knowledge and take up different roles in that quest for knowledge. The indigenous scientist is expected to respect and care for and cooperate with life and to coexist with life, and in doing that, in cooperating with life, other life forms will give up their secrets, so to speak, or will show us what we need to be shown. And inquiry, scientific inquiry, in the indigenous worldview is really about a search for meaning. It's about a search for life lessons, purpose, wisdom, and it's an attempt to, on the one hand, experience a sense of joy in being alive, a sense of connection to creation, and also to participate in the creative process, and to ensure that the conditions remain so that life can continue to recreate itself. So I don't know if any of you guys in the studio have comments on that. Yes.
It's something we've talked about a few times on the show, and I had the honor of working with Professor Deb McGregor a few years back as a research assistant who's done a lot of really important work on traditional indigenous knowledge. And one of the things that I've always found so striking about the difference and what you're talking about today, if you look at medicine, for example, and how, non-Indigenous medicine, you have a specialist who focuses very specifically on one part of the body rather than looking at how the whole operates. And I mean, to me, it again, going back to that fractal forest example, it just makes sense that you should look at the big picture first in order to understand the details. If you're only focusing on the details, you're going to miss the bigger picture, right? And that's how I've always thought of Indigenous knowledge, is that it's something that holistically takes into account all of the aspects of whatever is being considered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something I like about it is like how it deals with the whole idea of, linearness or linearity. Because, we tend to think of societies being more advanced and they, follow in this sort of line, this step. However, some of the societies that are supposed to be behind, they actually are ahead. Right? That in itself undermines the very concept of things developing in a linear way, because how is it that indigenous people around the world had a sense of like how the observer affects results before, Europeanized science had come to that conclusion, if in fact things did develop in this linear kind of way? Mm-hmm. So like the way that knowledge evolves in these different societies and communities around the world, it just quietly undermines some of the arguments made in mainstream science, and how mainstream science has had to adjust in so many ways to try to explain how that could happen. Right? And so they've abandoned the idea of linearity for the most part, but that was what ran the table for like 150 years or however long, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting how these different bodies of knowledge interplay with each other and affect what's considered true or what's considered speakable truth. Mm-hmm. Right?
I think also...
Go ahead.
I'll go. Sorry. I think also looking at the fact that we have had to really analyze what this objectivity within knowledge systems means, right? So those of us who are returning or participating within indigenous knowledge understand that the subjectivity in terms of healing needs to really be a part of the process. And I like the fact that you highlighted this idea of asking permission, and an animal or a plant will give itself over in terms of healing for the whole.
This brings me back to this history history network show, and it was about great thinkers and the makeup of their brains, right? And what really disturbed me is that, you know, they have, you know, Einstein's brain in a jar somewhere and they're studying it for all time, I guess. And they were talking about how he did exercises, like it seemed like they were describing meditation, you know, and how he goes into different planes. And I'm like, oh wow, that sounds familiar. Like, and it really kind of highlights what you were saying before, how the thinker or the person is really isolated and is not part of the community in Western science, kind of thing. They're separate.
Yeah, I think that it's really important when we're looking at Indigenous ways of knowing and doing to understand that there are always protocols for getting there, and that's part of what science has always tried to discredit Indigenous knowledge for, because there are spiritual protocols involved, and as soon as, you know, spirituality and science intersect, Westerners tend to dismiss it and think that, you know, it's no longer valid. We do have to take a very quick brief break. We're at the halfway point. When we come back, Zainab, I know you have some exercises that and some participatory things, maybe. We'll see. Okay, so you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We are speaking with Zainab Amadahi, whose recent publication, Wielding the Force, The Science of Social Justice, is available at Amazon.com. And we've got some important PowerPoint slides posted on our Vibe Collective Facebook page. You can check those out. Some really interesting questions, true or false questions that you're asking. We'd love to hear from our audience if you have any questions for Zainab or answers to the questions posted. You can give us a call at 416-946-7000. You can also tweet at us at Vibe Collective. And we'll be back after this very brief message on the Vibe Collective CIUT 89.5 FM.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we're back on the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM. As I said, it was a brief break, a very brief break, just to let the listeners know who and where they're listening. So we've been talking so far with Zainab Amadahi about her work in Wielding the Force, The Science of Social Justice, and examining Indigenous ways of doing, knowing, thinking, and observing the world, as well as healing. And it's one of my favorite topics. there's so much to know and understand about these ways. They often get viewed as new age or flaky, and you know, the validity of these ways of knowing and doing, it's taken a while for science to catch on. Now, I referenced Professor Deb McGregor. I encourage everybody to check out her work. She's done a lot of really important work, including these protocols in environmental assessment. Now, of course, with the current government, I don't think that's happening right now in environmental assessment for development. But there was a time when, you know, Indigenous protocols were being introduced into these processes. So Zainab, you've been going over some of the groundwork for your workshop. Where would you like to take it now?
Well, I I just wanted to mention in response to what you just said is that, or not in response or reflecting on what you just said, that Indigenous knowledges and many other people's knowledges have been devalued and ridiculed for many, many centuries. But we also have to recognize that simultaneously our ways of knowing have been thieved, right? They've been taken, right? You know, and thieved. And then, you know, patented and sold and all that kind of stuff.
That sounds really quick. I mean, that's kind of the point of devaluing, right? So it's easier to steal.
That's right. Yeah. The other point I just want to mention here is this concept of brain integration, where we know now that the more that the left and the right brain kind of talks to each other and collaborates and cooperates together, the better our physical and mental capacities get. And if we were to take that paradigm to society, and you know, as you know, some societies are more right-brained and others are left-brained or whatever, right? That the more cooperation we have, true, sincere cooperation, probably the better for all of us. The place that I want to take it, I know that Jemias would really like me to do the long fingers exercise on the air, but I'm reluctant to do that because there's a lot of breathing involved, and all you're going to hear is for a while, which isn't great radio.
Can you describe it at least? We don't have to do it necessarily, but can you just describe it for the listeners? Because it's a really fascinating thing. And I think probably a lot of people just in play, anybody who's tactile and plays with their hands has probably noticed experienced this experienced it.
So what the long fingers exercise is that I do in my workshop, it's also in the book. But basically, we go through a breathing exercise that is aimed at doing things to your biochemistry and your heart rate and your electromagnetic field and shifting it so that you're much calmer and more connected physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. And so we go through this exercise, and then what we do is we kind of line up the fingers. If you line up the fingers at the bottom of your hand and put your hands into the prayer position, for most people, one hand looks longer than the other. And that's for most people, but you know, there are people who have hands that are the same size. And so what we do in the workshop is we we make a change. So either we even up our hands, if that's what we need to do, or we lengthen one hand, set one hand over the other. And the breathing exercise is one where it's kind of to a rhythm. Anyways, I'll get to that later, but maybe I'll leave that with you, or I'll post it on my site or something like that, because I feel like I'm cheating you because of this. But it works most of the time for most people, and it's an example of what I think medical science likes, well, what New Agers are calling the mind-body connection, but what science likes to talk of as the placebo effect. Anybody want to take a stab at telling us what the placebo effect is?
It's like when you have a study and like one group is actually getting the medicine and the other group is not getting the medicine, and yet you'll still see improvement in that group that's not getting the medicine. So the suggestion is that it's purely psychological. So the body is, the mind is healing the body in that sense.
Exactly. Again, when I was studying as a medical technologist, there was a real lack of respect for what was called the placebo effect or the mind-body connection. And the assumption was that if you imagined yourself sick, you could imagine yourself well. But now that we have all of this wonderful technology and scanning equipment, we can actually see that there are changes in the brain and there's changes in biochemistry with the placebo effect. And it's very annoying to pharmaceutical companies, of course, who, you know, want to sell you drugs. But the placebo effect has no side effects and so forth and so on. Among the remarkable things that I learned when I was doing the research for this book was a study that was done in 2002 with arthritis sufferers at the Baylor School of Medicine, where they divided folks who needed surgery on their arthritic knees. They divided them up into three groups. And one group got the standard surgery, another group got an experimental surgery, and a third group had a fake surgery. where they made incisions and, you know, sedated the patient and made all kinds of sounds that you would hear in an operating room, you know, picked up and put down instruments and all this kind of stuff, and then sutured the patients up. And then they all got the same, all three groups got the same post-operative treatment, and they all recovered at the same rate, and they all were caught playing basketball for this TV show that was looking at the study and how this fake surgery had resulted in the same healing outcomes as the real surgeries had. So that's an example of how strong the mind-body connection is. There's also something called the nocebo effect, which is, you know, if you believe something's bad for your body, it's going to be bad for your body. And so there's some stuff that I look at in my book around that as well. There's a condition, this blew me away when I was researching, but in the medical literature, there's something that used to be called multiple personality disorder that is now called dissociative identity disorder. And what it means, usually it affects people who have been severely traumatized, but it's the idea that there's a lot of kind of personalities kind of residing in one body, and people can switch personalities that don't necessarily know each other and have the same, you know, experiences and so forth and so on. So with people who are suffering from what's called dissociative identity disorder, they have case studies in the medical literature where allergies will affect one personality and not the other. There are case studies where eye colors have changed with the switching of personalities, which is amazing because, you know, as far as I was taught, eye color was genetic and your genes were, you know.
By amazing, do you mean creepy? Like,
well, no. I know people are creeped out by that, but no, I just found, I find it very amazing because, you know, again, I'm fighting my colonial, you know, teachings as well. And so I was always taught that, you know, it would take generations or, you know, that silly exercise you do when you're a kid. And, you know, if someone with blue eyes married someone with brown eyes, what would the children, you know, because it's all this linear genetic stuff. But there's a science called epigenetics now, which looks at how, you know, your environment impacts your genes. And, of course, your thoughts and your feelings are part of the environment that your genes interact with. And body scars on the body. Come and go with the switching of personalities. Yeah. So I'm not going to have time to do a lot more, and I know that this is kind of an unusual presentation for radio, and I'm so glad. Thank you, Melinda, and thank you, Amnon, for like setting me up with the Facebook and all that kind of stuff. But I did want to talk about some of the interactions, like the science of human interactions. And I just want to say that, you know, with our thoughts and our feelings, you know, when we talk about stress, it's not a big stretch for people anymore to understand how our thoughts and our feelings impact our physical bodies and change our heart rates and change our biochemistry and change, you know, how our brain functions and all kinds of other things. And the longer you're in a state of, you know, the longer you're stressed out, or the longer you're feeling feelings like, you know, anger or fear or depression or grief or whatever, the longer you're in those situations, the more your body changes to accommodate. That is to make it easier for you to stay there and easier for you to snap back into those places. But the opposite is also true. And here's where I get a lot of flack from activists, because they think that what I'm saying is repress your negative emotions and just, you know, don't worry, be happy. And that's not what I'm saying, but I do want us to recognize that there are shifts as we shift into emotional states of appreciation, gratitude, love, caring, concern, joy, happiness, and even compassion, and even cooperation, even watching people do nice things for each other, watching a kindness, something called, well, I'm not going to get into that because it's too long, the Mother Teresa effect, look it up. but these have amazing, you know, wonderful changes in our body that enhance our immunity and help us feel more connected. Why are you laughing at me?
Oh, not at you, it's the term. The Mother Teresa effect.
Okay, since I said it, I better explain it. But what the Mother Teresa effect is, it was coined by this guy at Harvard who was doing some research with his medical students. And what he would do is take a sample of their saliva before he showed them a film about Mother Teresa. And then he would take another sample of saliva after they saw the film. And what he found was that their immunity had been heightened. There were antibodies in the saliva after the film that hadn't been there before the film. So this is one piece of research along with a whole bunch of other research that just shows us that, you know, there's so many healthful impacts, you know, in terms, again, of our biochemistry and our heart rates and all that kind of stuff when we, you know, can shift our focus to appreciation, gratitude, love, and when we can cooperate with each other, when we can be compassionate with each other, and even when we're observing other people being, as I say, good to each other. And even the act of smiling, you know, again, this is something that you can look up online, you know, counters the stress reaction and that it reduces adrenaline and cortisol, calms the heart, boosts immunity, lowers blood pressure, increases oxygenation, improves memory, learning, alertness, and creativity. It stimulates the release of endorphins, which are natural painkillers. It stimulates serotonin, which influences mood and regulates the cardiovascular system. And it increases the dopamine levels that make you happier and turn on the brain's learning process. So these are just some of the things that, you know, being positive can do. It doesn't mean that, I mean, we all need to experience a full range of emotions to, you know, be to lead a healthy life, but just so that we're aware. Yes, I sense you have a question or a challenge.
Actually, not so much a question or a challenge. It was actually more a comment on just generally how you were speaking about how we become disconnected from even sometimes the labels, like, for example, the Mother Teresa effect. I think the reason why people were getting a chuckle is I was ranting about this a few months ago about how Mother Teresa's particular approach to medicine included a particular connection between suffering and Christ being close to God for her. And so she wouldn't administer painkillers to patients. There were a series of historians and people who were investigating her hospitals because they could hear the screams of patients from outside.
Wow.
And so when I think of Mother Teresa effect, I think of something quite different than the compassion raising in people. Right. I'm sorry. So that was why the chuckling was happening.
Yeah, don't apologize. That's really interesting. And I think that's why, you know, activists have such a difficult time with this piece of my work because, you know, they think that, you know, I've had people tell me, are you telling me how to feel? Are you telling me I should repress my emotions? And certainly, you know, from my indigenous teachings, that's not what I'm advocating at all. What I'm advocating, I mean, a lot of our healing ceremonies are about feeling your feelings, all of your feelings, because you can't be healthy unless you acknowledge and recognize all those feelings. But I think we are being challenged to kind of change our relationship to our feelings, all of our feelings, and so that when we're in negative states, you know, that we can kind of take a step back and kind of recognize that, you know, we can shift this, that it will shift, you know, that these are temporary states, and that there are reasons for the way that we feel, and exploring those reasons, exploring the connection between what we're feeling and what we're experiencing in our bodies. I liken this to the journey that my youngest son made when he became a professional soccer player. And when he turned pro, I'm sure there was no expectation that he would never lose a game again or that he would never play badly again, but his relationship to the game shifted so that he was now enjoying a higher level of play and getting different kinds of benefits as a result of playing soccer. So I kind of like, you know, thinking of it as raising your game is another way I kind of think about it.
I have a question about just pulling back for a minute from this workshop and looking at the title of your book, and on the cover of your book, you know, the title is Wielding the Force, the Science of Social Justice. And then there's a warning. Warning, this book may cause an outbreak of healthy, sustainable communities, which I love. I think that's absolutely fantastic. We certainly need healthy, sustainable communities. Can you talk about, briefly, because we only have about 10 minutes left, your vision for these paradigms and how we're going to incorporate that into regular everyday practice, in particular with the activist community, as you know, those are the people who are, I think, you're targeting here.
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the things, I mean, for as an example of how I think this knowledge is applicable to our everyday lives, is the fact that I haven't gone through this a lot, but I mean, to lead you into this discussion, but We all give off, for example, electromagnetic fields. If you think of the stone that you drop in the water and, you know, the concentric circles that I mean, we're all doing that all the time. And within our there's emotional information that's encoded into those EM fields. What we found is that when there's two people, let's just go with two people because more than what, that gets a little complicated, but when two people are you know, sitting within 6 feet, because 6 feet is all we can measure at this point. It's not that the energy stops after 6 feet, but that's all we can measure. But if two people are in a room together, sitting close together, we've started to notice that their EM fields sync up. And the closest people who are well connected to each other, like they're in the same family or they're lovers or whatever, they'll sync up quicker. But even strangers will sync up. They're syncing up across species. So they've done, the Institute of Heart Math, for example, has done some work on a boy and his dog and how, ironically, the boy can sync to the dog. The boy syncs to the dog because the dog is, you know, pure love and excitement and is more grounded in love and excitement than sometimes we two-leggeds can be. There's syncing of EM fields across species. There's syncing of EM fields and the Earth's EM field. So we already know that the Earth's EM field, as it shifts and changes, impacts ours, our EM fields. And those, as I say, with every change in our EM field, there's a shift in our emotional, in our feelings, emotional lives, let's put it that way. So, and there are some studies right now that are going on to see if groups of people who are putting out or trying to radiate the same kind of emotions and who are radiating the same kind of emotions can impact the Earth's EM field. And the reason that this came to the attention of scientists is because I'll just talk about two incidences where the EM field of the Earth shifted quite dramatically. One of them being not when the 9/11 attacks happened, but when they started to be reported by the media, there was a huge shift in the Earth's EM fields. And we know this because we've got satellites all around the Earth now, you know, measuring these kinds of things. The other time that I'll just, there have been other times, but another time I'll just mention is Obama's first victory after the election. Again, when the media started to declare him as the winner to the world, there was another shift in the Earth's EM field. We're not at the point that science can translate what those shifts in the vibrations mean, but we know, I mean, the theory is that humans, a group of humans, can impact the Earth's EM field, and the question is, what does that mean? There's also some work around EM fields and how we can impact water. I don't think I have time to go through some of that, but in terms of the applications for activists, I mean, you know, I'm sure everybody has an opinion around this, but I offer the opinion, as I said earlier, that this goes beyond self-care, that it goes to, it speaks to how we build communities, how we act in our communities, how we behave with each other, and how we behave with our relations and the planet. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Zainab. I think you need to do a TED Talk on this, for real. I mean, this is, it's really, really important for people to recognize that, you know, we have such limited understanding of our impact and our relationship to each other and the world on that level that we are only just learning about, as you say. And when you start talking about electric magnetic fields, you know, again, that's I think that's where people start to get it's difficult for people to grasp, because again, that's taking us out of the linear and putting us into a different paradigm. But it's something that we've seen over and over. There was a big meditation that was done and we saw a shift there. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Because I don't remember the details about that.
I recall a couple of times where there were group meditations en masse to try to sort of, you know, shift certain things. But I don't know exactly the details either.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, just the the concept of that sort of collective work together, I think there's so much potential here in what you're presenting. So I really appreciate your work, and I hope you do a TED Talk, because I think this really would translate well in that paradigm anyways.
Maybe we should start our own TED Talks.
Vibe Talks.
Yeah, there's a plan.
We just need a stage and a mic.
Yeah, we just have to bring a camera. I have a camera.
Well,
can I just remind people?
I was just going
to
say.
My shameless self-promotion plug. To connect to me, to speak with me, to purchase the book, to learn about self-publishing, because this time, although I've gone with publishing companies before, this time I decided to self-publish. I might publish later with a publishing company, but for information on all those kinds of things, www.swallowsongs.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zainab. And once again, and your book is also available on Amazon. And will you be doing any workshops anytime soon where people can come and check it out and participate in Long Fingers and some of the other activities that you have?
Well, if you go to my website, you'll see that there are a list of gigs that I have. I'm going to be away in Aotearoa for the next month, but I do have some gigs for when I come back. I think this is the last one before I leave, though. Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking the time to come in and speak with us and give this illuminating talk on wielding the force. I think that it's a really good fit with, you know, the work that we do on the Vibe Collective. We talk about this sort of thing frequently, and I really appreciate your work. And I'm a big fan of you as a person.
I'm a huge fan of you guys, actually. I think I keep sharing your link around Facebook and all social media because I just really appreciate the spirit. It's not just what you know, too. It's the spirit with which you share it. And I just think this is a really important show to listen to. So, yeah, thank you. Well, it's an honor to be here.
Thank you for that. It's a big love fest all around. The EMFs in this room are just...
Buzzing.
Yeah, totally. We're sharing a lot of love here. So we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have these roundtable talks, and we talk about important issues such as social justice, decolonization, identity, resistance culture, environmental justice, and then Wielding the Force, the Science of Social Justice, with Zainab Amadahi. And you're sort of active on Twitter. I know you have a Twitter account. So you're at Amadahi Z, correct?
Oh my gosh, I don't remember. I'm so sorry. I'm old.
Okay, well we tweeted you earlier, and and then your website is
www.swallowsongs.com.
Thank you. And so definitely check her out. Now we've got to go to a brief break, and when we come back, DJ Griffin has some music to move you. And after that, DJ Badnan. And so once again, Zainab, thank you for coming through, and safe travels.
Thank you.
Okay, stay tuned after the break. More from the Vibe Collective here on CIUT 89.5 FM.